From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we feature a live concert with songwriter, record producer, pianist, and singer Alan Toussaint. For years, Toussaint's been a mainstay of the New Orleans music scene, working with performers like the Neville Brothers and writing hits such as Working in a Coal Mine, Mother-in-Law, and Yes We Can Can. Also today, I speak with Dominic Dunn. He writes about the very, very rich in his Vanity Fair profiles and in his new best-selling novel, People Like Us. Jazz singer Susanna McCorkle is back to conclude our month-long tribute to Irving Berlin. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the humor of Will Durst, a political satirist with a blue-collar perspective. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Alan Toussaint seldom performs outside of New Orleans, but today we have the pleasure of presenting him at the piano live from our studios. Toussaint is one of the seminal figures in the development of the New Orleans rhythm and blues sound. In the late 50s and early 60s, at the beginning of his career, he was the chief songwriter, producer, arranger, and pianist for Minute Records, which was the most important New Orleans record company of the period. And for that label, he wrote and produced the hit songs Working in a Coal Mine and Mother-in-Law. The Pointer Sisters later had a big hit with the song Yes We Can Can. Robert Palmer recorded Toussaint's Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley, and Betty Wright recorded Shoo-Rah, Shoo-Rah. Toussaint has produced records by Dr. John and the Meters, and since the late 60s, he's one of New Orleans' most important recording studios. Alan Toussaint joined us for an interview last winter, and when it was over, we invited him to visit at our studios for a concert the next time he was in the area. Today he's in Philadelphia to play at the Jambalaya Jam, which is a festival of New Orleans music and food. Alan Toussaint, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with a request to play one of the songs, one of the first songs that was a big hit for you that you wrote, Mother-in-Law.
Oh, yes, it was one of our very first ones.
This was originally recorded by Ernie Cadeau.
Right.
Would you play it for us your way?
The worst person I know, Mother-in-Law. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law. Every time I open my mouth, she steps in and try to put me out. How could she stoop so low? Mother-in-law, 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 mother-in-law. Why Satan could have been her name? Mother-in-law, mother-in-law. To me, they're about the same. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law. If she'd leave us alone, we would have a happy home. Sent from down below. Mother-in-law, 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 mother-in-law. I come home with my pay. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law. She asked me what I've made. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law. She thinks her advice is a contribution, but if she would leave, that would be the solution. And don't come back no more. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law, mother-in-law.
So how old were you when you wrote that?
Oh, let's see. I guess 21.
Were you married?
22. Oh, no.
Right.
But mother-in-law was a national joke.
Right, that's true. It really was at the time. Things have changed.
Yes. The mother-in-laws themselves weren't natural jokes, but most comedians used to use that.
That's right. I'm going to ask you for another request now, to play the first song that you ever recorded, which you also wrote.
Great. That would have to be Happy Time. Thank you.
That's great. No lyrics to that.
No lyrics at all.
Most of your songs have been songs with lyrics. That's why I asked.
Oh, yes. Well, those I began writing for other folk, but that one I wrote for myself.
So how did you first start writing songs?
Well, I came up imitating most people that I heard on the radio. I imitated most piano players, of course, and most all kinds of music. And after I would play and become totally saturated with it, I would sit and randomly play around. So little melodies came, and that started my writing.
You know, I think two of your influences have been Fats Domino and Professor Long here, two of the great New Orleans musicians. Do you think that I mean, I think they can be heard in your style. Would you play something of theirs and tell us how they affected you?
Oh, yes. Well, Professor Long here, I must say, of the local people, local meaning New Orleans and the New Orleans area, has been the strongest influence on my playing. And even some of my writing, the way I construct certain things. Early Professor Long hair, things like... When I first heard that as a child, that just knocked me out. And later on, Professor Longhair began to add things to his music like... He was very, very important to me.
Was it hard to learn that when you were young?
Not hard. It was very, very exciting. Once I heard it, I could get involved. It was just the idea of it, how unique it was to me. It was off the beaten path of most other things that were all generally related in some fashion. But Professor Longhair didn't seem related to anyone else who was out there at the time.
Now, I remember one of your... early recording sessions was filling in for Fats Domino because his piano track hadn't been laid down yet. You really could play in Fats Domino star Professor Longhairs and Ray Charles. How did you learn how to play like Fats Domino?
Well, Fats Domino was flooding the market. He had so many recordings out, and he discovered a secret to success with triplets. So as a child, immediately hear what that was, and most of his recordings had that in it, except for one, The Fat Man, which I thought was very exciting, but he never recorded any more like that, which was a very different kind of piano. It was kind of raunchy like... which was wonderful, but he never played like that again except maybe on one other tune. The rest of them was turned out to be mostly like the one I Want You to Know that I played on it.
Right, right, right.
Dave Bartholomew, who knew that I could play like most of the folk that were out at the time, called me in to play on a Fats Domino recording session. We were up to two tracks at that time, so we could do wonderful things. And he called me in to play like Fats would play this song, and I went in and did...
That's really great. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Alan Toussaint. And I should say, you know, whenever I've said your name, one day it would be Toussaint and one day it would be Toussaint. And so I asked you how I should really say it, and you said Toussaint. But your father's side of the family used to say Toussaint?
My father used to say Toussaint without a T on the end.
It seems very common for New Orleans families to have different pronunciations of their names.
Oh, yes. Bonaris, Bagnaris, yes.
Right, right, right. Okay. I'm going to ask you to play another song of yours, a song that you wrote. Maybe do another one of your early hits?
Well, Lipstick Traces. The guy, Benny Spellman, that sung the bass part on Mother-in-Law, he didn't know what it was worth at the time we were doing it, but when Mother-in-Law came out and sold and went to number one, let's say, Benny Spellman, that sung the bass part, made sure that everyone within the sound of his voice got to know that he sung that part. And he would go around, he would gig based on he sung the low part on Mother-in-Law. And he encouraged me with much force to write him a song that he could use that concept. And one result of that was this song, Lipstick Traces. Your pretty brown eyes, your wavy hair, I won't go home no more, 'cause you're not there. I've got it bad, like I told you before. I'm so in love with you, don't leave me no more. Lipstick traces on a cigarette, every memory lingers with me yet. I've got it bad, like I told you before. I'm so in love with you, don't leave me no more. Won't you come back home? Oh, won't you come back home? 'Cause I'm crazy about you, can't do without you. Won't you come back home? Lipstick traces on a cigarette, every memory lingers with me yet. I've got it bad, like I told you before. I'm so in love with you, don't leave me no more. Leave me no more, don't leave me no more. Leave me no more, mother-in-law, mother-in-law, don't leave me no more. I guess you can see how that happened.
He really owed you one after you wrote that for him.
Oh, thank you.
I love it when you can do both parts as you're singing the high part and the low part.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, yes.
No, another song you wrote that was a big hit, I guess it was the early 60s, Working in a Coal Mine.
Oh,
Lee,
yes.
Lee Dorsey recorded it.
For Lee Dorsey, yes.
Now, I remember when I interviewed you a few months back, you explained that you had never been in a coal mine when you wrote this song.
Not only never been, I don't know no one, know anyone who's ever been in a coal mine. And I don't know why that came. Lee Dorsey was a great inspiration for me. When it was time to write for him, I would just sit back and begin to listen to the sound of his voice. And I could always hear him singing lines to songs that I hadn't written yet in my mind. And one day, while sitting on St. Philip Street in New Orleans, I heard him saying, "Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down." I have no idea why. And it was like three times faster when it came to my mind than we end up recording it. But he was a great inspiration. His voice sounded like a smile to me. And I wrote lots of songs for him, just loads of them.
Which way do you play, Coal Mine Fast or Slow?
Oh, I play it somewhere in, a little slower than maybe he did it, yes.
Would you do it for us?
We'll give it a go. Working in the coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in the coal mine, about to slip down. Working in the coal mine, going down, down. Working in the coal mine, about to slip down. 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm already up and gone. Lord, I'm so tired. How long can this go on now? Working in the coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in the coal mine,
about to slip down, working in the coal mine, going down, 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 working in the coal mine, about to slip down. Of course I make a little money, hauling coal by the ton, but when Saturday rolls around, I'm too tired for having fun, too tired for fun now, working in the coal mine, going down, down, working in the coal mine, about to slip down, working in the coal mine, going down, 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 working in the coal mine, about to slip down. Lord, I'm so tired, how long can this go on?
That sounds great. When you write a song, when you wrote a song for someone like Lee Dorsey, would you play it for him to teach him how it went, show him how it went?
Oh, yes, I would play it and sing it with him. And the other artists that were recording at the same time, usually they would be right in the room, and when I'd write a song like that, they would sing the background to it. So we heard the finished product just about, except for other instruments, yes.
So you mean the first time everybody would run through it would be in the recording studio?
Oh, no.
Oh, this is...
In my parents' front room, where we did all of the writing and recording. All of the artists used to gather in this front room at one time, and we'd spend the day there. Ernie Cato, Benny Spellman, Lee Dorsey, when he came along with us, Irma Thomas. And when I'd write a song for Lee Dorsey, Ernie Cato and Benny Spellman would sing background for a while, until he get it down. Then I would write one for maybe Ernie Cato, and Benny Spellman and Irma Thomas would sing background, and we just had a party all the time going on.
It sounds like it really helped you to know who you were writing for.
Oh, heavens, yes. There was no other way for me to do it at that time. I never, during those days, wrote a song that an artist recorded, unless it was written for him at the time, while he was sitting there, he or she, of course.
And now?
Now I write songs many times because they just come, and there's no one present. But during those days, I was never alone through the day because the ladies and gentlemen, I'm having problems for this moment for some reason. But the artists would come early in the morning and wait till I wake up, and we would spend the day together, and we just had a grand time.
Well, I want to hear more of your music, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Alan Toussaint, who is one of the leading figures in New Orleans rhythm and blues. He's a songwriter, pianist, record producer, and singer. So we'll hear more of his music after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Songwriter, pianist, producer, singer, Alan Toussaint is my guest. And I'm going to ask you to do another song. You know, I've been listening to a lot of Irma Thomas lately. She has a new record out, and you wrote some of her early songs, and you wrote a song she sings on her new record, as a matter of fact. I'm going to ask you to sing one of her earlier songs that you wrote for her called It's Raining. Would you do that?
It's raining so hard, looks like it's gonna rain all night, and this is the time I'd love to be holding you tight. I guess I'll have to accept the fact that you're not here. I wish this rain would hurry up and end, my dear. I've got the blues so bad I can hardly catch my breath, and the harder it rains, the worse it gets. This is the time I'd love to be holding you tight, but I guess I'll just go crazy tonight.
Is there a story behind writing the song?
Well, with Irma, again, she was sitting right there that day,
mm-hmm.
and it was raining. And Irma was a great inspiration for me. I could write for her all day long. And sometimes I did. And she was sitting there, and it was raining, and I could see the rain hitting on the windowpane, and it was just perfect. Yes.
One of your best-known songs is an instrumental that was recorded by the trumpeter Al Hurt.
Oh, yes, Java.
Yeah.
However, I didn't title that Java. It was song number two when I wrote it.
How did it get the title Java?
Well, I was playing on a recording session, and the gentleman that was in charge, his name was Danny Kessler, and he kept saying, turn the piano up. And when the session was over, he came out to me and said, could you prepare an album for me in a couple of weeks? I said, of course, in a couple of hours if you'd like. It was all instrumentals. So I put a lot of songs together, and it was song number one, number two, number three. However, he was a racehorse fanatic. So all of the songs came out with racehorse names, like Java, Tim Tam, Nashua, Whirl Away. I didn't find out until maybe 6 months, a year later, that it was all racehorses, but that was his idea.
Did that bother you?
Not at all. It was song number two to me.
Would you play us song number two? That's really different than the Al Hurt version.
Somewhat. I modulated in the middle of it, yes.
Right, okay.
However, I didn't modulate on the original. I didn't have the audacity to try and modulate in that time.
Why, because it was an early date for you?
Yes, it was very early days and naive days for me. Not that I'm so much further away from that now, but I certainly wouldn't modulate.
Let's see. I'm trying to decide. We have... Let's see. What song do you want to play next? Another one of yours.
How about a song I wrote for Brother Art Neville?
And you've been working with him for years.
Yes. However, I wrote for Aaron Neville first. He was one of the guys in the mm-hmm. front room that would sing back and forth with others. And it was years later that I wrote for Art Neville also. And this song was one that I wrote for Art Neville. The touch of your lips next to mine get me excited, make me feel fine. The touch of your hand, your sweet hello, the fire inside you when you're holding me close. So warm and tender, the thrill is so, so divine. It is all these things that make you mine. If you would leave, why, surely would die. Once you were 10 minutes late and I started to cry. I've got it bad, but it's all right.
as long as you're here. Every night, your love so warm and tender. The thrill is so, so divine. It is all these things that make you mine.
Did Art Neville record it?
Oh, yes, he did, yes.
And I think someone else was telling me earlier that a country singer recorded it also.
Oh, yes, later on. In fact, I went to BMI in Nashville and picked up my country award. It was wonderful.
Oh, no, that's great.
Yes.
I'm enjoying you singing and playing so much. Do you have a new record coming out that will feature you?
Yes. In fact, I just recorded my first Mardi Gras album. And I've never recorded Mardi Gras songs in my life, even though living in New Orleans all my life. I love all of the traditional songs, so I didn't dare interfere with them, tamper with that success. But I was encouraged to write a certain Mardi Gras song called Mr. Mardi Gras by the gentleman that I nicknamed Mr. Mardi Gras in this album. And I used synthesizers, and that was quite daring to invite synthesizers to a Mardi Gras. But it came out very well, and we're happy about it.
Well, I guess you don't get to play piano much within the Mardi Gras parade.
No, not at all. Not at all.
So when's it coming out, soon?
Yes, it came out, in fact, last Mardi Gras, February. It came out right before Mardi Gras.
Great.
So we're hoping it'll be around for the next 100 Mardi Gras or so.
Well, it has really been such a pleasure to hear you play and sing. Thank you so much for joining us, really. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Alan Toussaint, who is a songwriter, singer, pianist, record producer, and he's joined us live for a concert today. He's in the Philadelphia area today for the Jambalaya Jam, which is a festival of New Orleans music and food. And Alan Toussaint has really been one of the centers of the New Orleans music scene for many years now. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Henry Mancini, and he's composed music for many films and TV shows, including The Pink Panther, Peter Gunn, and Breakfast at Tiffany's. I hope you can join us. Alan Toussaint, would you play us out?
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. rich and poor alike seem to enjoy reading about the problems of the rich. Dominic Dunn likes to write about them. Coming up, Dominic Dunn describes the conflicts between the old rich and the new rich. It's the subject of his new bestseller, People Like Us. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle concludes her tribute to Irving Berlin, who celebrated his 100th birthday this month. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews stand-up comic Will Durst. She says the only place she'll get to see him is in the comedy clubs because television is afraid of his political satire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. With only 5 dissenting votes, the Senate today ratified the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in time for President Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to exchange instruments of ratification in Moscow. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
After more than 70 hearings and 2 weeks of debate on the Senate floor, plus endless late-night meetings where deals were struck and decisions made, the Senate today voted 93-5 to ratify the arms control treaty with the Soviet Union. The final area of disagreement was worked out today. It concerned directions for the next treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START. The Senate agreed that any framework for START agreed to in Moscow next week should serve only to guide future U.S. negotiations. With that matter solved, the treaty was voted on, and the Republican and Democratic leaders of the Senate called President Reagan in Helsinki to convey the good news. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
In Helsinki, President Reagan said he's very pleased that he will have a ratified INF treaty to present to Soviet leader Gorbachev at next week's summit, but he says he still has concerns about the constitutionality of an amendment limiting the right of the president to reinterpret the pact. Earlier today, the president made a speech on an issue he says will be high on his summit agenda, human rights. Details from NPR's Bill Buesenberg.
In setting the tone for the Moscow summit in his Helsinki speech today, President Reagan was careful to mix criticism with applause. Applause for the new Soviet policies of openness and restructuring, for freeing political prisoners, publishing previously banned books, tolerating some dissent, and withdrawing from Afghanistan. Criticism for not allowing enough immigration, for still holding political prisoners, and for generally not institutionalizing its new openness in legislation and judicial guarantees. The president stressed religious freedom and once again urged a lowering of the Iron Curtain.
The Soviet leaders could agree to tear down the Berlin Wall and all barriers between Eastern and Western Europe. They could join us in making Berlin itself an all-European center of communications, meetings, and travel.
In Moscow today, Soviet officials reacted angrily to the president's speech, saying his criticism was out of date. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Helsinki.
The head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel today became the 4th top official to resign from the department in 2 months. Charles Cooper said he will leave July 8th. Cooper is resigning at a time when polls show most of the public has an unfavorable view of Attorney General Edwin Meese for a variety of allegations of legal and ethical impropriety, including Meese's involvement with the scandal-plagued WedTech Corporation. Cooper denied Meese's legal problems are behind his decision to leave. He says he's carrying out a previous plan to leave the Justice Department for private practice.
That plan was formed as a note in my letter in a calmer time, and was based upon professional and personal considerations that are entirely unrelated to the controversy that swirls about the department today.
Cooper heads the office that provides legal counsel to the Attorney General. His resignation is announced just days before a report critical of Meese is expected to be released by the independent prosecutor investigating alleged unethical behavior. After sidestepping a proposal to impose the death penalty for drug-related murders, the Senate today passed a nearly $3 billion defense bill that orders the U.S. military into the war on drugs. The Senate approved the bill by voice vote and sent it to the House, which earlier passed a bill with the same spending total. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 10 points, closing at 1954.44. Declines led advances by about 150 issues. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. During May, we've been devoting our weekly performance spots to the music of Irving Berlin, who just celebrated his 100th birthday. Singer Susanna McCorkle concludes our Berlin series by remembering the first time she heard the song Always.
When I was in high school in the 1960s, I went out for a while with a wild man named Tony, who drove his parents' car too fast and had a whole bunch of crazy, funky, bluesy records that the rest of us never listened to. His favorite one of all was Blues Organ. I can't remember the musician, and it was called Always, so I thought it was a new song. And I was very surprised to discover all these years later when I became a singer that this was an Irving Berlin song from 1925. I just hope Irving Berlin never heard that funky blues record of it, but it just goes to show how great his songs are, that they can stand up to so many interpretations, and every generation that discovers them thinks they're new songs because they sound so fresh. This is the way Irving Berlin intended Always to be sung.
I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand. Always, always, days may not be fair, always, that's when I'll be there. Always, not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but always, always, always.
In 1927, Irving Berlin wrote a song that's a perfect way to say goodbye to him and to his music. And I just want to say, as a singer and speaking for all the singers I know and all the musicians, how grateful we are to you, Irving Berlin, for all these wonderful songs you've given us to sing and play. We never get tired of them. I'm sure many generations after us will be playing and singing the songs of Irving Berlin.
You keep coming back like a song that keeps saying, remember, the sweet used to be that was once you and me, keeps coming back like an old melody. The perfume of roses in May returns to my room in December. From out of the past, where forgotten things belong, you keep coming back like a song. The song is ended, but the melody lingers on. You and the song are gone, but the melody lingers on. The night was splendid, and the melody seemed to say, summer will steal away, find your happiness where you may. There, neath the light of the moon, we sang a love song that ended too soon. The moon descended, and I found at the break of dawn, you you and the song were gone, but the melody lingers on. There, 'neath the light of the moon, we sang a love song that ended too soon. The moon descended and I found at the break of dawn you and the song were gone, but the melody lingers on and on and on and on and on and on. The song is ended, but the melody lingers on.
Singer Susanna McCorkle has been our artist in residence for our month-long tribute to Irving Berlin. She's been accompanied by pianist Ben Aronoff and bassist Chip Jackson. Susanna McCorkle will be back in a future Fresh Air with a tribute to Cole Porter. This is Fresh Air. Wealthy character in Dominic Dunn's new novel says this: "The kind of money we thought was money is nothing compared to the kind of money these new people have." Dominic Dunn writes fact and fiction about the very, very rich. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine, where he writes lengthy profiles of society people. His first submission to Vanity Fair was an essay titled Justice. It was his account of the trial of his daughter's killer. His novel, The Two Mrs. Grenvilles, was a best-selling account of murder among New York's social elite. Dominic Dunn's new novel about New York society is titled People Like Us. I asked Dominic Dunn about that phrase, people like us.
People like us is an expression that I have heard used in the last several years in New York. Some people shorten it to PLU. It is when the group that I'm writing about, the visibly rich of New York, when they talk about themselves, they say people like us.
Now, these are the old money, moneyed people, the people on the social register.
Yes, yes, it is the old money. It's the people that that talk about our own kind, or he's not one of us, they sometimes say. Or the other expression is NOCD, meaning not our class, darling.
Now, the wealthy in your new book basically divide into two categories. There's the old guard, the people like us types, and then the new rich, which you describe as the new people. Who are the new people?
Well, the new people are there's always been new people from the beginning of social life on. The new people are always the new rich, what they used to call nouveau riche, and what the nouveau riche always replied back is better nouveau than never. the nouveau riche, which in my book I call the new people, are these people that 6 or 7 years ago no one ever heard of. And now they are controlling in New York the philanthropic, social, and business circles.
In your novel, you describe the Oldrich as a kind of exclusive club, a club which has devised a set of signals so that they could recognize other people who are members of the club. Is that what you've observed in your travels through society? And if so, what kind of signals have you noticed people giving each other so that they can recognize that they're all members of the same club, the Old Rich?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me explain myself here. I mean, I am not a part of either the Old Rich or the New Rich. I am simply a journalist who has had access to this world. I think any writer writes what is available to him, and this has been available to me. I do have an ability for observing social nuance, and I don't know, it's mostly done where there's just a look. There's just people that catch each other's eye, you know, and it's just an expression exchanged that makes a comment on another person, an outsider to their circle.
You said that writing about the wealthy, it was a subject that was available to you. Well, how did it get available to you? It isn't available to all journalists.
That's true. You know, I went to the kind of schools where from the early part of my life, I have known people who were in this world. For many years, I was a movie producer in Hollywood, and there's something about the movie industry that opens doors to you. And then when I left that and began writing, I wrote the kind of articles that interested a lot of these people, which opened doors for me. And then the success of my novel, The Two Mrs. Grenvilles, made me kind of a perpetual guest in those same houses. And, you know, I always told them I was writing this book, People Like Us. And they would say to me, what's it about? And I'd say, people like you. And now here it is.
Well, I wonder if a lot of the people who had you as a dinner guest were hoping that you would maybe devote an article to them and help make them a social celebrity.
That I just don't know the answer to. Because I actually don't just write about social people. You know what I mean? I write about the world of. I mean, when I covered the trial of Klaus von Bülow, my article was not just about what the judge ruled in the trial. My article was about the world that Klaus von Bülow had come from and his wife, Sunny von Bülow, had come from. That's where my social reporting came in. I just don't write articles on a person who, because she wears a Christian Lacroix dress, because that doesn't interest me at all.
One of the characters in your novel is, in a way, based on you. This character is a journalist who also frequently writes about the wealthy. And like you, the character in the novel, the character named Gus Berkeley, has a daughter who was strangled by her boyfriend. But unlike you, the character in your novel seeks revenge. And I wonder what it was like for you to invent someone loosely based on yourself and give them that option of revenge, certainly something you never really you know, thought seriously about for more than a second.
Well, you know, that is one of the many advantages of being a novelist, in that you can create a situation in which you can deal with your innermost feelings. You can do things in a book that you can't do in life. It was a strange thing. When I got to the point in the writing process, I had discussed this with my two sons, that I was going to do this. And when I got to the point in the writing process where the confrontation between Gus Bailey and Lefty Flint, the name of the character who has been released from prison, meet, I couldn't make the character of Gus Bailey pull the trigger. There was something within me that I couldn't, even on my word processor, I couldn't get the words out of me. And I wrote that scene, I think, maybe five different ways. And it finally came out the way it is in the published version of the book. I don't know, comfort, it isn't a feeling of comfort, no. It's a very disquieting feeling, and it just proves to me what I've always believed anyway, that vigilante justice is wrong, and what's happened to me is something I simply have to live with.
You know, we talked a little bit about, well, let me put it this way. I think a lot of people who are rich like reading about the rich, and a lot of people who aren't rich enjoy reading about the rich. Do you think it's a different kind of enjoyment both groups get out of it?
Yes, I do. I do. I think it's a very good question, too, and I think it is. I think, an editor of mine once said to me, you know, there's nothing that the public enjoys so much as the rich and the powerful in a criminal situation. I think there's great satisfaction for people to read about people like Ivan Boesky, to read about people like Leona Helmsley, who has not certainly gone to prison, but it's not impossible that she could go to prison.
But what's in it for you? I mean, the person who you referred to said that there's a certain pleasure people get about reading about the rich in criminal situations. You're writing about that. Are you doing it just because you think it's going to sell, or does it give
you
a certain pleasure to write about that kind of situation, that kind of setting?
Well, in the first place, I think it's a very, very true statement. And, gosh, every writer wants what he writes to sell. But I'm not doing it just for that reason. I mean, I think it is something that is very, very true. I'm always interested in newspaper stories that appear in one edition and never appear again. There was a recent story that I read where it said, "Millionaire Socialite Murdered." Now, that's an interesting headline. And yet, there was never any follow-up to that story. And I think to myself, who called the newspaper to tell them to back off that story? That's what I want to know. That's, by the way, what my next novel is going to deal with, that kind of power.
And that interests you?
Of course.
Okay. Would you like that power yourself?
Absolutely not. But I certainly want to expose it.
Okay. Dominic Dunn, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dominic Dunn's new novel, People Like Us, is published by Crown Books. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's up?
Well, the Senate, after much delay, has finally ratified the INF Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And that treaty will soon be heading, like the president, to Moscow so that Mr. Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev can sign it. Also, Attorney General Edwin Meese has lost another top aide. Assistant Attorney General Charles Cooper resigned today. And we have a story on learning English by radio. And, Terry, this is a great story. It's about a BBC program that teaches millions of people around the world English through using unconventional methods, like a soap opera with a character who's hard of hearing, so you have to keep going, "What? What?" and repeating the sentences.
Well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic at large Laurie Stone says the networks don't like to broadcast political humor, so the best place to find it is in a club.
Ever hear of Will Durst? Probably not if you depend on TV to introduce comics. On Durst's first and only Letterman shot, he ignored the staff's instructions to tell lifestyle jokes and went for his strength, political comedy. A Reagan dig was bleeped. It went like this. The president is on the radio saying, "The bombing starts in 5 minutes." That's his idea of a joke. My idea of a joke is to give Hinckley a bigger gun. Durst hasn't been asked back on Letterman, and he considers himself banned. According to the show, he just wasn't funny. Sure. I didn't see the segment, but I can imagine Durst squirming, futilely searching Letterman's sneering face for some connection to the world. A few weeks ago, at Caroline's Comedy Club in New York, Durst juiced a crowd hungry for thinking comedy. There aren't a lot of political comics, but with political theater so arid during these Reagan days, stand-up is at least one field of performance where you can get some argument with government in power. Durst wheels on stage, long hair flying, a cigarette balancing on his lower lip. At 34, he has the face of a hound dog in need of a good night's sleep. He likes acting the part of a no-mush guy. A kid annoys him on a plane. The kid's mother says, "What's the matter, mister? You don't like children?" Durst comes back, "Yeah, with lemon butter and capers." But Durst has plenty of heart. Lots of comedians take swipes at politicians, usually at ticks and names. If I hear one more male comic say the vice president is a wimp because he's named Bush, I'm going to cut off his mic. Durst is among the rare breed with a coherent point of view. He grew up in Milwaukee, working as a third-generation machinist for Alice Chalmers. His father drove a forklift. Durst did a factory stint until comedy paid off. He evolved into a populist, suspicious of hierarchies and alive to blue-collar angst. Nothing piques him like preachers and Pauls. He goes on about the Catholic Church. Some of its clergy have AIDS. Yeah, they finally have to admit some priests are drug addicts. He moves to Pat Robertson. God told him to run for president. God should sue for slander. Durst likes Jesse. He'd be pleased to see an ethnic candidate in office, say Cuomo. But as for getting votes in the heartland, well, based on Durst's experience, Mario is not the name of the president. Mario is the man who runs the Tilt-A-Whirl. That job might be just the ticket for Dizzy Ronnie, Durst quips. Reagan didn't know he was shot. That scared me. Call me silly, but I like a president with a central nervous system. Reagan gets cancer every 6 months, he notes. Nose, colon, nose? You figure it out. He's amused, too, by our government's hard line on dictators. Duvalier is in the south of France. Marcos is in Hawaii. I bet Noriega is having nightmares about Tahiti. Durst needs more material and more confidence. He looks disappointed if the room isn't noisy. But not everything he says is laugh-out-loud funny, and it needn't be. When he reminds us that Reagan vetoed the Clean Water Act, what was going through his mind? Something between a snort and stunned silence is right. Even if Durst gets further shots on TV, the medium isn't bold enough to inspire his best work. That's what clubs are for. See him. Give owners courage to book acts like this.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with jazz singer and songwriter David Frischberg. He'll join us at the piano to sing a few songs and to answer questions about his attorney, Bernie. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review a collection of recordings by saxophonist Ike Quebec. They were originally recorded as 45s, when jazz jukeboxes were common in neighborhood bars. And television critic David Bianculli will salute a TV show that premiered on American television 20 years ago, the British mystery adventure series The Prisoner. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.